one of the senior Dharma teachers here at Boundless Way Zen, and who was practice leader at the Ralph Waldo Emerson Sangha.
Good evening, everybody. Please sit comfortably. Tonight I would like to talk about case 41 of the Gateless Gate. I'm going to read us Koan Yamada's translation. Koan Yamada is four generations back in our own ancestry. Bodhidharma sets it at rest. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch, standing in the snow, cut off his arm and said, "Your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, Master, give it rest." Bodhidharma said, "Bring your mind to me, and I will put it to rest." The patriarch said, "I have searched for the mind, but have never been able to find it." Bodhidharma said, "I have finished putting it at rest for you." I find this going funny. And I find that the more I spend time with Zen, the more of it I find funny. So I want to spend a little time just talking about this koan on a character and story level, and then I want to go in a little deeper and ask, what was it that Eka, who is would go on to become the second patriarch, was looking for when he says his mind is not at peace? What did he find when he says, I have searched for it? And what is there to be found? So that's where we're going to go. But I want to start out looking at a little bit of this line by line. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. This facing the wall is the fundamental practice of Soto Zen. This is just sitting. This is what Bodhidharma did for 7 years in the cave. And what I think is interesting about this koan is that it doesn't say Bodhidharma sat in deep, vast samadhi amidst the sparkling prajna wisdom emanating enlightenment. What it says is Bodhidharma was facing a wall. And and the simplicity of that versus what we hear, what we imagine Bodhidharma is doing, what we're sure that a great master like Bodhidharma must be doing when he's facing the wall. That's something important right there. And then this translation calls him the second patriarch. Another way of referring to him is as the second great ancestor. Or Bodhidharma is the first ancestor of Chinese Zen, and his disciple Eka would go on to become the second ancestor. He is not yet the second ancestor in this koan. The second patriarch, standing in the snow, cut off his arm and said. So right there, right, that's proof that we can never live up to the standards set by the ancestors and patriarchs. Here he was standing in the snow up to here, you know, and he was just standing there in the traditional kind of Zen way, waiting to be acknowledged by the master, you know, who he could see was right there, clearly doing something totally different than what he was doing. You know, so he was waiting, standing in the snow, and at long last said, and then in order to demonstrate the traditional Zen story says that he cut off his arm in order to demonstrate his real commitment to the path. Now, the thing is that insofar as any of these things have historical grounding, this isn't at all what happened. Eka Huiko was a general in the Chinese army. He actually lost his arm in the war, this is a major after-the-fact thing. In fact, anything having to do with Bodhidharma is extremely sketchy. There was somebody who brought Zen from India to China. He may or may not have been Bodhidharma, and he probably didn't do say most of the things that are attributed to him. So here we are, diverging a little into legend for the sake of dramatic effect. But I think for the purposes of appreciating this, I want to point to the actual reality here, which is that he'd already lost his heart. And so he says to Bodhidharma, "Your disciple's mind is not yet at peace," which is something that I'm sure we all relate to on some level. Obviously, this is why we come to practice. I beg you, Master, give it rest. And now, so this isn't the beginning of the second ancestor's practice. He's been practicing for a while. And he says, "Your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, Master, give it rest." And here, when I picture this story, so Bodhidharma doesn't look up. He's just still facing a wall. And maybe when Eka cuts off his arm and sets it down, Bodhidharma looks at the arm. He looks at Eka, and he goes back to facing the wall. "I beg you, Master, give it rest." And then Bodhidharma, perhaps not even looking away from the wall, maybe turning to Eka in all sincerity, says, "Bring me your mind, and I will put it at rest for you." Or maybe, you know, Bodhidharma is usually depicted as, bearded earring barbarian, you know, so maybe it wasn't as civilized as all that. Maybe he just kind of gruffly said, "Bring me your mind, put it at rest for you." Didn't even look up. The patriarch said, "I have searched for the mind." So this is how we know. This is how we know he didn't just walk in off the street and demand to Bodhidharma that he put his mind at rest. "I have really been engaging this practice. I've searched for the mind. I have taken the backward step. But I have never been able to actually find the mind." And here is where I'm sure Bodhidharma makes eye contact. He says, "There, I've finished putting it at rest for you." Wonderfully, what this koan doesn't end with is, "And then the second patriarch became enormously enlightened." So what's going on? What is it? What is the second patriarch looking for? He's looking for peace. What does he have? What is that peace? He has some idea of what that peace is going to be like. He has some idea of what enlightenment is. He has some idea of what it is that Bodhidharma, the master, has that he does not have. He has, and he looks inward and he sees, he has an idea of himself. Too. He has an idea of himself as somebody whose mind is just not at peace, is never settling down. Or, you know, he has a self-image. He has an idea of himself as, you know, the guy who just can't make peace with his body, and here he is cutting off his arm, or he can't make peace with his loss of an arm. I'm going to read a number of, in this Dharma talk, a number of quotes from a book called Saying Yes to Life, Even the Hard Parts, which I worked on with Ezra Beda. One of the lines that is in Saying Yes is Ezra says, "Are you still caught in the dream of an enlightened experience that will leave you permanently clear and peaceful?" And, and... And so is the second ancestor. He has this idea that there's something he can get that will definitely put him at peace. So he sits. When he sits zazen, and we know he does because he didn't just walk in off the street, he sits and he sees, all he sees is, you know, his own craziness, which is the same thing that we all see when we sit. in our own crazy mind. And in a way, what he's saying to his to Bodhidharma, his teacher, he's saying, do you see how crazy I am? I am so crazy. I am so not at, yet at peace. I just really haven't gotten it. I just want to make sure, and this is something that I have said to my own teacher, James, repeatedly, I just want to make sure you know how crazy I am. Let me just tell you briefly, and he never buys it. For which I'm enormously grateful. Second ancestor here is caught in he's caught in a curative fantasy. He has some idea that Zazen is going to fix him, that Buddhism, that the Dharma is going to fix him, that Bodhidharma is going to fix him. But when he sits, all he finds is his own experience. And here's a quote from a book in progress from David Loy. David Loy is actually a Dharma heir of Kōan Yamada. He says, usually that void at our core is so uncomfortable that we try to evade it, and that void is whatever we sit and we find and when we're whatever comes up for it. For Zazen, this not yet at peace, this craziness, this whatever. Usually, that void at our core is so uncomfortable that we try to evade it by identifying with something else that might give us stability and security. Another way to say that is that we keep trying to fill up that hole, yet it's a bottomless pit. Nothing we can ever grasp or achieve can end our sense of lack. This is one side of what's going on here in the I have searched for the mind but has never been able to find it. No, nothing has ever filled up this hole. Another thing that's going on here, what this is pointing to is what we find when we look at what this self is. Now, what this mind is, and here mind and self are synonyms. David Loy goes on to say, the point isn't to get rid of the self. That's not possible, for there is no self and never has been. But nor do we want to get rid of the sense of self. That would be a very unpleasant type of mental retardation, which is an important point. You know, we hear in Zen about no self, and then we form some concept of what that no self is, and then we try to manifest our perhaps mentally retarded idea of that no self. Rather, what we work toward is a more permeable, less dualistic sense of self, which is more aware of and more comfortable with its empty constructiveness. So when we look at any moment of our experience, any moment of thought, we see that it is constructed. It's comprised of what the Heart Sutra calls sensations, perceptions, discrimination, awareness, mental formations, volition, all our beliefs, all our dispositions, all our habitual karma, all our habits of mind, the mental formation that's the conditioning of our personality. Those are all the things that are there. And part of what the practice of sitting of sitting and opening the hand of thought is creating a wider perspective, a bigger container with which all of these things, the aggregates, the skandhas, these mental dharmas, the sensations, the perceptions, the beliefs, and all the rest, they arise and we see them, but we start to see that we're also not them. We start to break our identification with them. So we just see that the beliefs are present, the reactions are present, the craziness is present. That's interesting. And so, I mean, if we can change it and it becomes pleasant, but it's here. From the wider perspective then, and here's what Ezra Beda says, from the wider perspective of the witness, the limited sense of self coiled tightly around unwanted emotions begins to expand. We then see this self for what it is, a complex of deeply held beliefs, physical sensations, distant memories. So this has been really helpful to me in all of my moments of great suffering. You know, whether it's physical or psychological, whatever it is that I'm, you know, whenever I come to be really kind of narrowly identified with my suffering, the practice of stepping back and looking at what's actually here, what's actually going on. Well, there's this tightness in my chest, there's this kind of rushing in my ear, there's this thought that's just really holding my attention right here. And when you're able to see it in these broken down kind of specifics, then that's what gives you a little more space around it. And you see that it's just a sensation. It's a sensation of tightness in the chest. And then there's also the aversion to that sensation. And that's also here. And then there's also the belief that I shouldn't be feeling these things. And there's also the belief that if only I were a good Zen practitioner, I wouldn't be experiencing this kind of tension. So this is, the second ancestor finds. His version of these things is what he finds when he's looking for the mind. And, you know, there's another koan in which it says mind is Buddha. You know, so maybe the second ancestor is looking for Buddha. He's looking for enlightenment. He's looking for peace. And I haven't been able to find it. I found all these things. I found that there's this experience of this, there's this thought, and I found all these other things, but not that peace. And then Bodhidharma says, I have finished putting it at rest for you. That's it. That's it. And this is... Ezra Beda says, until you practice with the messy, unromantic, ordinary ups and downs of everyday life, any efforts to feel calm while sitting on a cushion will be no more than a temporary detour from the truth of your life. What if there is nothing else? What if our ideas of what we're looking for are just that? They're just ideas that arise in our mind. What if our belief that this is completely unacceptable, that this is not enough, what if that is just another mental dharma that arises in our mind? And maybe there will be some moment of peace that comes. You know, if you sit zazen enough, you will have a moment of peace or something that comes. And maybe there'll be a really big, remarkable moment of peace. But those things are just other things that arise in the mind. It isn't about having one state and keeping it. It's being present to whatever's here, whether it's the craziness and the not at peace or an experience of great peace. David Loy. So, what happens when we don't run away from that hole at our core? That's what we're doing when we're meditating. We are letting go of all the physical and mental activity that distracts us from our emptiness. Instead, we just sit with it as it. It's not that easy to do because the hole gives us such a feeling of insecurity, ungroundedness, and unreality. Meditation is uncomfortable, because in our daily lives, we are used to taking evasive action. So we tend to take evasive action when we meditate too. We fantasize, make plans, feel sorry for ourselves. But if I can learn not to run away, to stay with those uncomfortable feelings, to become friendly with them, something can happen to that core. And to me, insofar as that hole is what I really am. The curious thing about emptiness is that it's not really a problem. The problem is that we think it's a problem. It's our way of trying to escape it that makes it into a problem. That emptiness is not a problem. That not at peace is not a problem. Ezra Beda says, peace is not found through seeking peace, but through residing completely in what is. And whenever we hear language like this, residing completely, then we make that into some special thing, you know, like, well, residing completely is really just really some kind of Zen being in this. But it's sometimes residing completely is in our just regular, plain old, crazy, not at peace, mind bouncing all over the place, anxiety having, unsettled self. Just being with that. That's what it feels like. That's what it feels like in that moment. There isn't like a deeper it to really reside in. One last quote from Ezra. As we relentlessly observe ourselves, the images we have of who we are and who we need to be, which at one time seemed so real, begin to peel away like layers of an onion. Pleasant self-images may give way to uglier ones, each seeming equally real, until that layer too peels away. As every illusory idea of who we are is stripped off, we can finally experience the quivering freedom of not needing to be anyone at all. Not needing to have any peace at all. Not needing to be able to find this and call it our mind. This and say, this is who I am. This is the problem right here. Dharma has finished putting it at rest for you.
And yet, I still feel my fists clenched on something. It all makes sense, you know, when you talk about it, when James talks about it, when Melissa talks about it, when David talks about it, it all, you know. Just in listening, I feel as though I can sit back and unclench the fist. But the rest of my life, it goes back to grasping at all of those things, at the idea that pit is a problem, at the idea that.
Yes. And that's it. You know? And so when you see, here is me grasping at that idea that the pit is a problem. And that's okay. You know, sometimes it feels this way. When you're listening to a Dharma talk, it feels this way. When you're in the middle of, when I'm in the middle of one of my episodes of craziness, it feels another way. And to really just even entertain, what if, even though I also have the experience of being sure that this can't be it, what if this is it even now? Entertain it as a possibility, and see if you can, this craziness, this clenchedness, you know, even as we're clenching, We don't have to open this hand, you know, that in order to be with that moment. The moment is this clenched hand. Oh, this is me being really, really crazy right now. And that's what this moment is. And you can also notice this is me really wishing for another moment. This is me wishing for that other moment I had yesterday when I was listening to that really good Dharma talk. And that's a fine thing to feel too. It's so beautifully simple, you know. And there's no situation to which it doesn't apply. Shinran, the founder of the Pure Land School of Buddhism, talks about true and trusting as being grasped by Amida Buddha, never to be let go, and that's what the Dharma is doing. This is the Dharma. Will never let you go once you reach that. Once you just let it in that moment too, or even don't, or even you just be with the not letting it in. You be and it's so like beautifully recursive, you know. And it's so completely not dependent on the state of your mind. It's not having some particularly good mind state. It's not having a body that sits zazen. It's not having this in your mind or that other thing in your mind. Or this, and it'll be there available to you as you're on your deathbed, or as you're, you know, awaiting your execution in prison. For all of your kind of people.
Periodically, I go back to my book on Mu Mu, because I've been such a guest. And recently, I was reading something that goes along very well with this. One of his stock things is to give a sermon that goes something like, I keep telling you, monks, that you have everything you need and there's nothing wrong with you. So what is your freaking problem? So what you want to do is follow your problem to its source. Well, he doesn't really say what happens.
Sounds like a lot of work. Just be with that problem. And so this is also and what is that source? So there's one answer in which it's a lot of work, and there's another answer which it's really not. But yes.
Well, that's the best.
Yeah. Thank you.
I always find it amazing that whenever I hear a long talk or if I read something just perfectly appropriate happened to me that day. And it's this morning I was driving my carpool of kids to school out in Framingham, drive all the way to Framingham, and my son gets a call from one of his friends begging, can you please come by and pick us up because we don't know where to school. And I had this appointment in the afternoon that I was completely unprepared for because I was supposed to be work last night. And so I immediately just went crazy. I literally went crazy. I was like, you know, fuming and saying, can't do it. At the same time, I knew exactly that the right thing to do was to pick them up and take them to school, because just the nice thing to do. You know what? You know, when you arrived to school, I was nearby. I wasn't going to be any more prepared for my interview in the afternoon. The thing that I just stuck with it. I just sort of tried to breathe a little, and gradually I realized all those things. You know that. That all those things were really what's going on. It was about me. It wasn't about the inconvenience. It wasn't about that I didn't have room in my car, all the excuses that I came up with. But what you said, I think, was really great. It was like just just entertaining, entertaining being with what's going on for a little while, you know, is what counts, is letting it in, letting it happen, and watching it happen.
And also, sometimes, just being with your inability to entertain, that maybe it just this is it.
If you sit, you see. If you jump around, you see. You can't miss. You have to see.
Yeah. No, you can't miss the ground.
Then
Dogen says no being fails to cover the ground over which it stands. Throw yourself at the ground, you can't miss. Look for this moment, you can't fail to see it. This moment might be a fantasy of something else.
So I'm talking about this, this avoidance, this that I know very well, this big sucking hole. I've spent my entire life trying to fill with something.
Yes. But yes, we're definitely trying to fill up something that doesn't need to be filled. And when we're experiencing that void, that you know, big sucking hole, it's not the shunyata aspect of shunyata. It's the form and aspect of shunyata. That's the form that all of this emptiness is taking right now. The form of it right now is this feeling so crappy. This great sucking hole that nothing can fill up. That's emptiness expressing itself as form. So, but it isn't precise. It is. I want to just be clear that it isn't that shunyata, which is the Sanskrit word for emptiness. It isn't that refers to our psychological feeling of emptiness. But that void that we try to run away from and can't. And find that we're not at peace with. What if even the impulse to run away, or even noticing that we've been running away, what if that also is it? What if that is Bodhidharma reaching down through the centuries to put it at peace for you? Boy, would that suck. And what if that's it, too? Bodhidharma was kind of a jerk, though, wasn't he?
Why was it facing that wall?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it was him encountering, you know, maybe it was him really just steadfastly encountering his own demons. You know, maybe he was facing the wall because he was, I don't know. I mean, personally don't feel the call to go and face a war in my for 7 years, so I can't precisely speak to it. But I'm grateful that Bodhidharma did. That was the way Bodhidharma's path manifested. That was what it meant to be him. That was what it meant to be that guy. You're this guy. You make models. You do these other things. For which the world is grateful. Did you say rawness or wrongness?
Wrongness.
Uh-huh. Either one would be good. Yeah.
Right. But that I think ends up happening when all of us are trying really hard to just hang out with whatever is coming up and resist the impulse. Sort of, you know, that phrase about sitting like your hair's on fire always gave me the image of running screaming from the room. And the sensation of hanging out with the parts of us that feel most vulnerable, most at risk, and most prone to the parts of ourselves that we least want to bring forward and hang out with. And I guess I just wanted to say that one of the truly wonderful things about a retreat is the sense of gratitude arises from hanging out not only with yourself but with everybody who is making that effort to just hang out with in that space of uncertainty over however many periods of time. Whether we're doing this here or
And that's what it feels like in the last day of Sesshin. And then the day after that, I generally experience some kind of rebound other thing. And there's an easy temptation to go, oh, that thing that I had yesterday, that was it, I had it, I was so connected to that. But it's also being able to be within the rebound craziness and the, you know, the refractory period of whatever too. Yeah, which is, and Sesshin is wonderful for being able to, I think, point out for us that thing that's always available to us, even when we're crazy, or even when we're in a different kind of more contracted crazy, it's still available to us. It's just easier to see in Sesshin. Thank you all especially for your attention and engagement and heartily joining in.